This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Music and politics have been linked for a long time. The connection has been important to resistance movements of the 20th and 21st centuries. And an Austrian composer named Hans Eisler deserves some of the credit. He changed how a mass audience heard politics and music. The Jewish musician tried to subvert the Nazis with protest songs in the 1930s. He was forced to flee to the U.S. Despite a successful career composing for Hollywood, Eisler was eventually put on trial and deported by the Americans for his communist affiliations. His work as a political composer is featured in a conference at UNC Chapel Hill called Hans Eisler Today. It takes place Friday and Saturday at the Person Recital Hall at UNC's campus. And joining me now is Stefan Litvin. He is a composer and a music professor at UNC and also a speaker at the conference. Welcome back, Stefan. Good to have you
Good
here.
Good to be back.
Tell us about Hans Eisler and how he changed the game for contemporary music.
Well, Hans Eisler was one of these prodigious students of Arnold Schoenberg. Arnold Schoenberg was the father of modern music, probably the most important contemporary composer, and probably the most significant composer of the 20th century. And he had a strong pedagogical leaning and had, you know, dozens of successful students. But there were three he always called his main talented students, Alban Berg, Anton Webern, and Hans Eisler. Now, Hans Eisler, in opposition to the other two, from the very early days of his life, was already a Marxist. And Schoenberg was not a Marxist. So we see from the earliest development of Eisler that he starts trying to balance the two poles. On the one hand, Schoenberg's genius and what he learned from him. And on the other side, his political leanings, which were not in tandem.
So here's what we have to do now. We have to connect the dots. We think of music, modern music, certainly a great sea change in music when we get to 12-tone, atonal music that Schoenberg presents. What's political about that?
Well, that's the whole point. You could argue that Arnold Schoenberg's transition to atonality preceded or anticipated by just a few years the downfall of the Habsburg Empire. So that's very, very political. The dissolution of tonality, the revolution in music. Yeah. But politically, Schoenberg was a conservative, a monarchist. Now, Eisler saw that Schoenberg was losing his audience because of the radical language he was employing. And Schoenberg said this was a historical necessity. And Eisler said, as a Marxist, the historical necessity is we have to write music for the rising class, the working class, and they have a different type of music to listen to. So that's the consequence he drew.
Let's get a sense of Eisler's music as a student of Schoenberg when he's trying to get his head around this atonal concept, which, as you say, is a kind of an intellectual concept. It's going to appeal maybe to the few rather than the many. But here's a piece, or at least a section, of Eisler's Piano Sonata Opus 1. It's a clip of Piano Sonata Opus 1 by composer Hans Eisler. His work is featured in a conference this Friday and Saturday at UNC Chapel Hill. My guest is composer and music professor Stefan Litvin, so no earworm there. This is what identifies this music, right?
And yes.
Go off humming this. On the one hand, revolutionary, because it's changing the whole concept of music, but in Eisler's view, reactionary, in the sense that it doesn't speak to the
people. Well, I have to come to the defense of Schoenberg here. In this moment, when he wrote this sonata, Schoenberg actually suggested it for publication at Universal Edition before the piece was actually finished. He was so thrilled with what Eisler had produced as his student. And it was Eisler was put on a trajectory of becoming a great avant-garde composer. So at that point, when he wrote that piece we just heard, he was still completely a Schoenberg right. student. But it was just a few years later where he decided that's not my path.
And what was his path? What was he listening for, and what was he trying to create?
Well, having been affiliated with early communist movements in Austria and Germany, he then sought out to become a collaborator of Bertolt Brecht. And that became sort of his calling. This happened in the late 1920s. So there is a, by the way, a very funny farewell cycle for voice and piano that Eisler says farewell to the bourgeois concert aesthetic. And he sets, instead of, you know, high poetry like Schoenberg and others were setting at the time, he just sets newspaper clippings to music. So there is that process of separating from the Schoenberg school. And then he starts writing choruses for men's choirs, working class choruses, and theater music. Music very much like Kurt Weill in the Three Penny Opera, using jazz idioms, which was the new music of the oppressed. So he starts writing proletarian music.
And Bertolt Brecht, by the way, his collaboration, I mean, interesting because there's another North Carolina connection in that Brecht also collaborated with Paul Green, the great playwright here, when Green was up in New York, and they had a great collaboration and friendship.
And then
as well.
Kurt Weill came down to North Carolina to write Johnny Johnson with Paul Green.
So you have all these connections. And but again, now we're seeing the evolution of Hans Eisler as he's trying to appeal more to people who a different class of people. Let's listen to this clip. It's from the Song of the United Front by Hans Eisler. Let's listen. Well, that one I could imagine people humming in the shower.
It was written so that they could hum it in the shower and on the streets.
Tell us more about that, Song of the United Front. Tell
okay,
us
well,
that one.
This was actually written in 1934 after Hitler had taken power in Germany, and Eisler and Brecht were already in exile. Brecht went to Denmark, and then they met up in London. So this was written actually on a spur of the moment. I think Eisler talks about it, that he wrote this piece in 10 minutes, not in this orchestral version we just heard, but the melody and the harmony. And Brecht tried to unite an anti-fascist front. So, you know, rather than just go for the communists, anybody against Hitler was good as a member of an anti-fascist front, and that's what is called the Einheitsfront, the front of the United Front against Nazism.
And of course, this becomes this great challenge. Whereas music, by the 19th century, had been a kind of unifying factor, one of the elements of nation building and nationalism, trying to build this a nationhood beyond borders, right? A camaraderie that expanded or went beyond borders.
Early Leninist Trotskyist idea, of course.
That idea, and we're seeing examples of it here. Now, Brecht and Eisler did, as you say, and we should talk a little bit about Eisler's background, because while Jews may not have considered him a Jew, the Nazis certainly did. His father was Jewish and his mother was Lutheran. Am I right?
I don't even know. It's possible. But his father was a private professor of philosophy. You got me there. I don't actually know if his mother was actually Jewish or not.
If you believe them.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about them either.
Eisler didn't consider himself a Jew in the first point. But, of course, he would have been persecuted by the Nazis immediately. But being a communist, he was on the blacklist right away.
Right. So he comes to the U.S., collaborates with Brecht, and they start writing, you know, they ended up in Hollywood, right? Talk about his experience in Hollywood.
Well, Eisler and Brecht had collaborated also in the film industry already in the Weimar Republic with two anti-fascist films, one called Coole Wampe, which was made in 1932 in order to help galvanize the working class against the Nazis. It didn't succeed, obviously. So by the time they met up in Hollywood in the late 1930s, early 1940s, Eisler was equipped to work in the Hollywood film industry and became very successful at it, making quite a bit of money. And he was nominated twice for an Oscar, one anti-fascist film called Hangman Also Die, and the other one, None But the Lonely Heart. Brecht had much more of a difficult time in Hollywood. He didn't speak English well, and had to start working in English somehow. He had some fortune that, for instance, Charles Laughton took an interest in him and actually played the main role in Galileo Galilei. But Brecht hated Hollywood as a representation of all the bad things of capitalism. And Eisler shared the political view, but had a better life, of course.
Well, it's interesting because he's collaborating with the Capitalist Project, which is getting everybody to be good consumers, but you know, yeah, through Hollywood. On the other hand, how you mentioned two films that were overtly anti-fascist. How, you know, so how did he navigate his political ideas and ideals over and against the success in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think as long as it was anti-fascist, and as long as the Nazis were the main enemy of the United States, he was fine. And his communism was tolerated. I mean, he was never an active member of the party. Neither was Brecht. I mean, really, I think the two of them were anarchists. They didn't really fit into a party political realm. I think it was only after the war ended and then the Soviet Union became the archenemy of the United States where they started drawing attention to themselves by their inclinations, of course. But Eisler would have been happy, I think, staying in the United States had he not been deported then by the McCarthyism.
Well, I want to get to that, but I would talk a little bit more about his success because Eisler was, in fact, nominated for two Oscars for his film scores. One of them, the 1944 film None But the Lonely Heart, and we've got a clip from the film's trailer. Let's listen.
So sweeping in scope and of such depth and power that it's destined to become a memorable screen achievement. None But the Lonely Heart stars Cary Grant in the most unusual role of his brilliant career as Ernie Mott, whose world is bounded by mean streets, whose ambition it is to take life as he finds it, and for whom women are a source of disturbing desire.
Every time you kiss me, it gets deeper.
There we go. 1944. None But the Lonely Heart. I don't remember that film. But Hans Eisler was nominated for an Oscar for his work on the score, and his work will be featured at conference this Friday and Saturday at UNC Chapel Hill. Stefan Litvin helped organize and will speak at the conference, and he's my guest this hour. So we're talking about his success. He's sort of navigating these worlds. It's okay to be fascist and communist. He's not a communist party member, and he does ultimately renounce the excesses of Stalin, and you know realizes that this is not what he's all about. But too late. The HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, is already underway, and by the end of World War II, he comes to their attention.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting point you raise about turning away from the Stalinist perspective. It wasn't so easy to do. I think both Brecht and Eisler knew, no doubt, what was happening after the show trials. That was the latest that they would have known. And it's interesting that, you know, Brecht, who actually fled through the Soviet Union to the U.S., didn't stay in the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, I think they both feared fascism so much that they thought, well, Stalinism is the lesser of two evils. And, you know, we have to deal with the kind of Marxist movement that exists. We can't build our world on promises of something that doesn't exist. So I think it was a Faustian pact that they made.
Well, you don't want to give aid and comfort to the enemy either, and that's sort of your bind.
Yeah,
you realize that
yeah.
You know your side is really messing up, and some of the spokespeople.
Well, and it was a tragic turn of events. In fact, that Eisler's sister, who was married to a Trotskyist, her husband was killed in a mysterious way in Cuba, and she blamed her own brothers for having been instrumental in this murder. And she was the one who then convinced McCarthy to have Eisler appear in front of the tribunal.
He was unapologetic in
his Eisler, appearance. Absolutely.
In his appearance and rather bold, I think.
Yeah, they called him the Karl Marx of music. And then he said, you know, what an honor. I can't accept it.
He ends up, he's deported and ends up in East Germany, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about his time there.
Well, now this is probably the tragic turn of events. I think, as I said before, Eisler would have done very well staying in the United States. He was making money. He was a successful film composer. Now he had to start over again for the second time in his life as an immigrant. He wanted actually to go to Austria. But they wouldn't get him a job. And West Germany was out of the question, of course, because that's where all the Nazis were. Apparently, East Germany was where, and I'm saying apparently, was where all the old communist fighters would return. And there was sort of a sense that, you know, if we're going to return to Germany, we're going to go to that sector that is run by the Soviets, and we will build a new and better Germany. So that was also what Brecht felt. And all these returning emigrants of, you know, thousands. And at this point, Eisler started teaching composition at the Hochschule für Musik, which is called after him today still in Berlin, Hans Eisler. But found himself surrounded by Stalinist cultural attachés, people who had no idea about the arts, but were starting to dictate Stalinist doctrines. And especially the Zhdanov decrees of socialist realism, where anything that was deemed avant-garde or just for a small circle of listeners would have been killed by calling it formalistic. And Eisler's most tragic experience in this context was when he published the libretto to an opera he was going to write himself on the Faustus myth. Remember, he was friends in Hollywood together, friends with Thomas Mann, with Theodor Adorno. This was a cultivated man, and he himself had this project of writing a Faustus opera. He published it. He was extremely excited. Brecht helped him with it. And then a formalism debate ensued. And it caused him so much trouble that he left Berlin, went to Vienna. He already had a tendency towards alcoholism, and this just made it even worse. He never wrote the opera, unfortunately for us today. And he basically succumbed to the petty bourgeois mentality of these so-called Marxists.
So, and in fact, he did write the German Democratic East Germany's national anthem. Right?
Well, that was the other unfortunate situation because those who hadn't known Eisler's work from the Weimar Republic or exile in the United States identified him with being a Stalinist composer, which he wasn't. But indeed, as an attempt at creating a new type of better German society after the Holocaust, he and Johannes R. Becher, who was also a communist exile who returned, they created a whole set of songs called New German Folk Songs. So remember, the Nazis had completely appropriated the folk song literature. Yeah. So all of these typical songs from the 19th century already had a fascist connotation by this time. So Eisler and Becher said, we write a new socialistic type of folk song. And among those was the anthem.
Very briefly, I don't have very much time left, but what do we take away from this? How do we remember Hans Eisler?
As one of the most talented, productive, and intelligent composers of the 20th century, I think he was remarkable in his diversity, able to write for any purpose. And as the composer, I would say, and that is really his historical significance, as the composer who discovered the functionality of music, that when you write for a certain audience, you have to adapt to that appropriate style. So style, the use of style becomes a parameter in compositional thought, not just pitch, tone, color, rhythm, and dynamics.
What a pleasure. Stefan Litvin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stefan Litvin is a composer and music professor at UNC Chapel Hill. He's going to speak at a conference taking place Friday and Saturday called Hans Eisler Today. It's on the UNC campus. It isn't today. It's Friday and Saturday. You get the idea. Anyway, you can find out more about the conference at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we look at transgender politics on the State of Things. Stay tuned.
das liebste Max und Scheinen, so wie andern Völker ihr's, so